Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I am your host, Phil Iskov, and with us today, we have Emmy Willis, past and future guest, I'm sure. She was on for a Freaks and Geeks episode. I can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, it was...
Doesn't matter.
An episode.
It was great. Everyone loved it.
Yep.
And more of that.
Big fan.
Emmy Willis, who wrote on She-Ra and is now currently on Star Trek Lower Decks.
Yes. And this fall, 2020.
Really?
Your TV.
Do we know that for a fact?
Oh, yeah. Okay. It's been announced.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Look forward to it. And Sean Bennett, also a writer in his own
Hi,
right.
Hi, everyone.
That is the voice of Sean Bennett.
Hello.
He worked on Elementary and on...
Most recently I wrote an untitled Walking Dead game for Skybound Entertainment.
Do you have any idea when that's going to see the light of day?
No.
I wish you could
Absolutely.
Have seen Sean's face. It's fantastic. someday it will happen, though.
Yeah, be great. No. I feel like people are going to lose a lot of my weird nonverbals. But I feel like 50% of my
nonverbals. Is that the name of your book?
Gosh, if only.
So we're going to talk about Trekkies today. Everyone's favorite documentary about Trekkers or Trekkies. How do you guys do? You Trekker sounds weird to me.
It does.
Right?
The part where Catherine, what's her name? Kate Mulgrew was talking about the difference between Trekkies and Trekkers.
Yeah,
she thought about it. Oh my God! How it was a verb and it was action
to mean forward.
To be walking with us, and a Trekkie was a very passive word.
I admired how much thought she put into it. Like my only experience with it was when I was buying Star Trek action figures one day at like a department store in Connecticut when I was however old, and it was the only time ever the checkout person just decided to make a bit about it, and they said are you a Trekkie or a Trekker? Oh, which do you prefer? And I was just remember sitting there holding out my money, please
just
sir,
take my money.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a weird that Trekker, I don't feel like I hear that very often.
No, not
at all. It's pretty infrequent.
Yeah,
it's also
Trekkies.
Why this was not called Trekkers. For
exactly.
The record.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, it's so I saw this documentary in. Actually, Ernie, can you turn me up just a touch? Sorry.
Up.
Yeah. This came out in 99, although it's a weird thing because there's people saying it came out in 97 in some versions of the internet, which I don't completely understand.
I think it premiered in 1997.
But then was released in theaters in 99.
Yes.
All right. So that's what we're going with. That's why we're talking about it on this podcast. I remember seeing it in 99 and, thinking to myself, these people are deeply strange. And part of it was because I think at the time, first and foremost, and this is sort of, I spoke to you guys about this before, but I want to talk about sort of fandom on the macro to a certain degree, because mm-hmm. I think that this movie walks a very interesting line between love and not hate, but sort of making fun of these people.
Certainly.
And yes. And that's a hard sort of, you know, waters to charter to a certain degree.
Well, it also feels like it's very easy to kind of look at Phantom and be like, look at these weirdos.
Right.
But now, you know, 20 some odd years later, right. That's the norm. And like, I have a ton of, you know, truck right. toys. Literally, sure, we sure, bought sure. a new truck toy. Oh,
congratulations.
Yesterday.
Yeah, thank you.
What'd
thank
you,
you
get?
I was at Golden Apple Comics and they had a bunch of vintage, 1995 era Star Trek sure. toys. And
it's I got vintage,
you know. Yeah, I know. And I got a Worf.
Nice.
Yeah.
My fave.
Worf looks so weird without the makeup. Is that weird
he's
for me to say?
He's a very handsome man.
He's an attractive man. But it's like seeing him without the makeup just makes his face look
Yeah, and it's
odd.
The teeth, too. It's not just the forehead and the hair, but it's the teeth that...
Yeah.
Make a man.
And weird.
And, like, I just think they're, like, it's more, I always find it more jarring with Worf, Michael Dorn, because I feel like with LeVar Burton, Geordi, at least, like, there's a lot of imagery of him without the visor.
Yes.
In
well,
pop
reading
culture.
Rainbow.
Exactly, yeah, which was concurrent. Even though I've seen Michael Dorn without the Worf makeup, like, watching it in the documentary, I was like, oh, yeah. That's him.
It's weird.
And Brent Spiner, certainly, I mean.
Yeah. Spiner femmes, guys.
Oh my goodness.
We will get there.
We'll get there. I think it's interesting that sort of it feels like the first documentary that I can remember that tries to explore a weird little corner of fandom or just people that are very sort of fanatical about a thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it does a relatively good job of it, but I can't help but feel like at times they certainly seem to be kind of like laughing at them a little bit.
Yeah. It's also such a it's not just a corner of fandom, like it's a very very narrow corner. Like it's the people who go to conventions, it's the people who, you know, make their dentist's office a Star Trek shrine. So I think, you know, it chose to go that niche and it could have chosen many different other niches to include in fandom and but I think one of the things I was missing certainly was the fans and the fanatics who do go on to, you know, like Barack Obama was a huge fan.
Yeah.
Stacey Abrams, huge fan. And, you know, my boss, Mike McMahon, huge fan of Star Trek, made a Twitter account about Star Trek, now writes a Star Trek.
So
I think it kind of – it chose to do the most – I don't know, like not base, but like the easiest way of making fun of fandom rather than saying fandom actually opens up a lot of possibilities for more people to pursue other things.
Well, I guess my question, and perhaps you guys know the answer to this, I don't, but were the Star Trek conventions sort of the first convention of its kind in that capacity? Like, did it, because like I watch this and I'm like, Comic-Con now. Is like what it, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like was this a common thing? I imagine there weren't many fan bases that had conventions like this at the time.
Yeah, I think this is the first like primary like one thing fan base that had conventions like this. I won't pretend that I did not do the research. I don't know. I know Comic-Con itself is pretty old.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised if they start around the same time.
Right.
But like looking at this, like just the way that, and part of the thing that I guess like I thought was really cool watching this was remembering like, oh, this is 1999. Like the internet web store sort of, you know, world wasn't really available yet. So for a lot of these people, this is the only place you could go to get Star Trek stuff.
Right.
And the way they're like, you know, trading like rare toys there, like that's all on eBay. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, you can still do it in person, but you know, why would you?
Well, it's like there's one guy, the one kid that I guess we would say is sort of the protagonist of this movie, if there is one.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, someone asks him, like, how do you know this stuff? He's like, oh, I'm on the internet.
Yeah.
And he says it in a way that's just like, oh, that's so adorable. But yeah, it does feel like, the internet brought your message groups and your various other sort of ways of bringing people together. But these people would get on planes and drive places to be with other fans of this thing, which is... It's a really lovely thing, and I do think that Star Trek as a property or as a universe building, that feels in in tune with the property. The property was very sort of like intellectual, but also about sort of bringing people together. I mean, it really was sort of a, it wasn't a particularly action packed series when you really think about it. It's
How
very,
dare you?
Yeah. I mean, come on.
The Dominion War. Those last 10 episodes of Deep Space Nine, that was an event.
Yeah, Kirk and Spock fighting to the death.
Well, okay. I mean, in the sense that, like, it was a little bit more sort of it felt – well, wasn't it about them going around the world trying to – or the universes or what have you, talking to people and trying to, like, deal with things through talking, not through fighting? Wasn't that sort of, like, one of their big things?
Oh, yeah. It was
like
all
diplomatic.
About – yes. Yeah. But that's some action. There were bad guys who, you know,
sure,
shot
there were
your
Klingons and your – what was the other –
Romulans.
Romulans. That's what it was.
Borg,
sure.
The Ferengi.
Sure.
We can keep going.
I guess my point –
the Changelings.
And we'll dispense with speaking of this new sort of iteration of Star Trek quickly, just because I don't think that it's necessary to go down that rabbit hole. But it does feel like one of the things that the new versions or the new movies at the very least were kind of dinged with was that J.J. and co. tried to infuse more Star Wars into this Star Trek and make it a lot more sort of action-packed, when as a series it wasn't necessarily known for being – that action oriented. That's not a ding against it. I actually think that's one of the things that makes it really interesting, but that's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Star Trek episodes, at least like TNG, The Next Generation, you know, the most exciting moments were in the boardroom when, you know, Captain Picard would sit down and be like, thoughts? And everyone would talk about their feelings and thoughts and talk about diplomacy.
What a show this was, guys.
Everybody makes a suggestion and the captain, you know, sort of grades them all. And it's
what a
usually,
time to be alive.
It's usually an incorporation. Yeah, I mean, again, like I tweeted recently that like Star Trek is a lot of like competition. Porn, which in this year 2020 is
we
just
need.
Like, yeah, really I mean, I found like it used, you know, it used to be like I'd come home from a hard day and watch The Office, and now I'll come home from a hard day and watch like 6 hours of Star Trek just to be like,
it feels right,
yeah,
yeah, because there's so little of it in this world,
yeah,
that
yeah,
right
level
now.
Heads can prevail,
but it's just that's sort of what I'm getting at. That it felt like a show for thinkers, and I don't say that again in a derogatory sense in either direction. I know that there are people that want action in their television shows or their movies, and there's nothing wrong with that, but I also understand people that want, to your point, to watch a bunch of people in a boardroom talk about their feelings and mm-hmm. being competent, which in and of itself is special.
I think that's why so many fans are – I don't want to misspeak, but there is a certain fandom of Star Trek that is moms. It is a mom show. Mm. It is a show where, you know, someone's going to make some tea. Someone's going to make some coffee if they're Janeway, and they're going to, you know, figure this problem out. And
yeah, they like Picard. So that's
moms love Picard.
Yeah, my mom loves Picard.
My mom loves Picard too, and I love Picard.
Right, sure.
I love Sisko. I love Janeway. Not a Kirk person.
Yeah. So okay. So I'm just going to get out of the way the synopsis of this documentary, which is a little tricky to find. So for people that do want to watch it, I would either download it illegally through torrents, or you can buy the DVDs for like six bucks.
Wow.
Not even talking around it.
Well, it's out there. They're making it difficult to watch this thing. So I'm not. But listen, you can buy it on Amazon. It's like $6 or $11 or something like that. There's ways to watch it, and it's well worth watching. The science fiction TV franchise Star Trek has had a seismic impact on the lives of the most obsessive fans. Known as Trekkies, these diehard devotees wear their Starfleet costumes in public, speak in Klingon, and even redecorate their offices and homes to mimic the look of the Star Trek world. In this documentary, former Star Trek actress Denise Crosby travels the country interviewing famous fans like Barbara Adams and exploring the reasons behind the show's enduring appeal. Trekkies opened in theaters on May 21st, 1999 in a limited release, basically made back its budget, which was around $300,000, but it became a kind of a pretty big cult hit on video, and then they made a sequel, which I have not seen. So I don't know. The sequel might be great. Hard to tell.
I think the sequel is more about the international fandom, which I'm actually kind of curious to watch too.
Yeah. Trekkies has 86% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics and 70% from audiences, which I find interesting. I'm surprised.
Rude.
Yeah. I'm surprised that audiences were kind of shitty about it. But Ebert gave it 3 out of 4 stars. You know, critics seem to really like it. So here's a bigger question, and I don't, again, don't really have an answer, but I'd like to unpack this. Are these people out of their minds?
No.
No.
How dare you?
And I
also think it's like,
there's definitely some people in this thing. Okay, let's talk about Barbara Adams for a second here.
Hero.
So Barbara Adams, for those who don't know, was a juror in the Whitewater scandal trial who wore her Starfleet Academy uniform every day.
Cool.
And became a thing. Like, it, people talked about this person, and she, you know, there was
I can see Sean wants to correct you.
Is it, did I say it wrong?
She's not in the academy. She's an officer.
I'm going to need to curb this. I think we're all going to be doing, like,
well, isn't she a commander? Do they call her commander at, like, the Kinko's that she works at?
Well, yeah, but thereby she's graduated the academy, you know?
Okay. She's wearing a Starfleet uniform of some sort.
Phil has never wanted to strangle her.
No, that's not true. That's absolutely not true. I guess what I'm trying to get at is her logic within the documentary was that people don't make fun of people for wearing sports uniforms in public. Why should I be embarrassed to wear this?
And that's
but then she goes one step farther and says, why shouldn't my fellow officers also wear? So there's, I guess my question is, does Barbara Adams have the firmest grasp on reality?
Ooh. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the movie is definitely trying to.
And I don't. I'm not disparaging her name. She seems great. I want to make sure that we're all on the same page on what I'm speaking about in terms of the lines of blurring reality and fiction.
And I think one of the, I was going to say characters, but one of the fans, they make mention of how. Wouldn't it be nice if we lived in a world and in a future where Star Trek and the, you know, the diplomatic ideals of the Federation and Starfleet were the blueprint for how we exist in the world and how we exist going forward? And isn't that wonderful? And I think there
is
an idealism that's attached to some of this fandom. But yeah, it's certainly, you know, people choose different things in this life. They choose to wear a Lakers uniform. They choose to wear a cross. They choose to wear a comm badge.
I'm not really disputing
that point. It's when she tips into this idea of it being real. Like, the difference between loving Star Trek and those characters and loving a sports team is that one of those things exists in reality. The other doesn't. So that's where I get like, I love a whole bunch of fictional characters. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I wear t-shirts with their images on it all the time. But I don't think they're real. Like, I don't think that my fellow fans of that thing are, you know.
Yeah. But I think officers. To my point, it's more like it's holding on to this ideal of like, wouldn't it be nice if it was real?
Right.
Yeah. I think some of it does have to do with like the ethos of Star Trek, which is about like striving for ideals and accepting other people with all their differences.
Right.
I also think part of it, as I was watching this documentary, is just like, back then, a lot of this stuff was more fringe, like even stuff we'd have now, like to your point, like, yeah, I can wear like, you know, X-Men shirts walking around now in Los Angeles and it's fine. But I remember like, you know, in like the late 90s, like my parents would just be like, I mean, like wear that shirt like to school with your friends, but like don't wear it out other places, you know? And I think just the climate was a little different.
Totally.
And I think as a sort of byproduct of that, like the people who were diehard fans were maybe much more concentrated in that fandom, in like, it was more of a badge of honor to wear your Starfleet uniform.
Badge of honor.
Oh, I like what you did there. I think there's also something to be said too for, I mean, we live in a franchise universe now. I mean, comic books are commonplace. So being a fan of those things now is not something to be quote unquote ashamed of. If it ever, it never was, but there was a time when maybe you would have been a little bit more closeted about these things. So I get that. And that's why this movie is a little bit of a relic. I think that if you did this movie today, this movie would be,
completely different.
These people would be, you know, canonized. So it's interesting to see how this industry has changed, but also how fandom has changed. And so I really wasn't trying to be disparaging. It's just trying to figure out this is a odd assortment of people that they've put together in this movie. For good or for bad. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the documentarians are handling it with kid gloves necessarily. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to sometimes not feel like they're sort of shining a light on people that might be slightly unstable.
I'm not trying to correct or stomp on it. Like, I think part of it is also like, I would not be surprised if there was a documentary about like fandoms before this of a similar mm-hmm. focus, but I think this is one of a very early look,
right.
like deep dive into this. And watching the documentary, it kind of jumps from like area to area to area mm-hmm. of fandom and its impact. So for that reason, like, it left me thinking like it, because it is shifting focus so quickly, you don't really get like a well-rounded look at so many things.
Yes.
So you just get to see like Barbara Adams walking into and out of mm-hmm. the courthouse in, mm-hmm. you know, her Star Trek outfit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, that's weird. It was cool that with her, they then follow her to her workplace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you see that her coworkers are all just super chill with it.
Yeah,
like, it's become like an in-joke. And some of them have even said like, well, yeah, I mean, I started watching Star Trek just so I can understand what Barbara's talking about. And they were all very mm-hmm. chill with her mm-hmm. In a way that like her introduction in the documentary maybe did not indicate. It made it look like she might be seen as like an outlier by everybody.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that window into her work life helped sort of truthfully just make her feel like more of a person
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
less of a an oddity that they were sort of, you know, pointing a camera at. So I mm-hmm. I completely agree with that. So the main kid, whose name unfortunately I don't know, should I know this
Brandon?
Person's name?
I've got it written down, one second.
Sean took notes.
Oh.
Gabriel Kerner.
There we go. So Gabriel is introduced getting his uniform from mm-hmm. Who made his uniform?
One of the was
it like
friends?
His one of his friends or
yeah.
one of his like
yeah.
the mom of his friend or something like that?
Yeah, it was an acquaintance, and he was getting the brand new Starfleet uniform
right.
that had just recently debuted in Star Trek First Contact,
which he was wearing. I actually really like First Contact.
Yeah,
it's a great, we should talk
uniform.
About the movies, like what the best movies are
yeah, yeah.
at some point
oh,
as well.
Yeah.
But he quickly starts to give notes.
Yes.
Yes.
Which I'm just like. And then he does it again when he gets the next
exactly.
uniform later. It's like, you gotta stop being so...
I mean, this is a man who should learn how to sew himself.
Correct, correct.
So many thoughts on it.
Correct. Well, like, yeah, and I like a lot of the cosplay stuff would be interesting to discuss because, like, looking at this, it's like, oh, yes. yeah, so much of this is, like, a forebearer for cosplay culture. But, yeah, mm-hmm. I did find it, like, that odd endearing thing where he's like, thank you for doing it, but, like, these command rank, you know, signs
yeah.
are way too thick. They're
yeah,
not
this
that
is too thick. And this...
like, I oddly found it kind of endearing that it's like, oh, man, like, like, I get the passion, but also, like, just say thank you. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also something interesting about the dynamic he has with his father.
Oh,
which
yes.
is really,
yes.
really sweet in the sense that the father is happy that he has a thing with his son, like that they have a thing that they can do together, which is mm-hmm. that's very nice.
I actually think that's a big thing about Star Trek is it's one of kind of the last shows that you
family
could
shows.
Watch as
yeah.
a full family.
Mm-hmm.
Like
100%.
You know, it certainly got horny, but it never got sexy. So
well, yeah, it got horny.
We can parse out that.
Oh,
but
I mean, we'll get to
I
it.
Have thoughts. I
yeah,
have thoughts.
When we get to Starbase Dental, there's some husband and wife there are 100% cosplay.
Yes.
Oh yeah. No, and like I think the documentary does a good job of like touching upon that, but similarly doesn't go quite so deep
yeah.
into it.
Some of those drawings of Data with what's her face,
Tasha Yar.
Yeah,
my first ever crush.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Was she the? How did she die on the show?
It was like a black
goob. Yeah,
it's
okay,
a black goo
was the
thing
one that, died
that is like, you know, in a very sci-fi way, it's like the concentrated evil of a planet that, like, you know, the people vacated and they just left their bad behind, and it's this like goo thing that just shoots Tasha Yar dead one day.
Why did they kill her? Was there a reason?
She actually had respiratory issues because of all the fog that was used on different planets. And because of her, they changed the fog. They changed how they did it on set. So she kind of, you know, was the sacrificial lamb yeah. of how they were doing production. But
having been on shows with atmosphere, as they call it, actors really hate it.
It's unpleasant.
Just put that out there in general.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not they have respiratory issues or not, it is gross to inhale that for seven mm-hmm. hours a day or however long you're doing it. But
I mean, they bring her back in kind of a spectacular fashion.
Yeah.
Has really she come back?
It's Yesterday's Enterprise, and it's a really great episode.
it's like a parallel timeline story.
And only Guinan, Whoopi Goldberg, knows that something is wrong and that Tasha Yar isn't supposed to exist in this world.
That's pretty cool.
It's really good.
Yeah.
It's
and
a
then
great
like,
episode.
You know, they really follow through on it in a way that's kind of admirable that like a, you know, like network syndicated TV mm-hmm. show would do back then in a way that feels very serialized now that like, you know, her coming back into our timeline has, you know,
it has consequences.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Speaking of Whoopi Goldberg, I loved the Uhura
Michelle.
Story.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic.
It was really neat.
That's such a great thing.
Yeah. But yeah, it's like, I think watching this documentary, I'm craving more of those fan stories.
Yes.
Of just what like normal is the wrong word, but like just what an average fan who is super passionate about this stuff, but
they needed to pull more of those into it. It felt like everything was dialed up a little bit too much because
here's again, the most extreme
it's a little
fan,
bit
yeah.
about,
right.
like, you know.
But yeah, like especially with the original cast members in the documentary, their personal interactions with fans I thought were some of the most just like beautiful parts of the documentary. Like
totally.
When James Doohan talks about getting the fan letter of someone, this woman who was like thinking about committing suicide, and he just told her to meet him at the next convention, and they did this for what he said like 2 years
yeah.
where he would just tell her, I'm gonna be at this convention, I want to see you.
That's
there
lovely.
And then she gets her master's degree in engineering like that yeah. was really beautiful. And like,
you know what was another beautiful story? It was when the guy who played Bones talked about that sexy photo.
Yeah, that was about to say
that
thing.
Was weird.
That was bizarre.
I lost it.
DeForest Kelly being dirty.
Yeah. Dirty old man.
I mean, ugh. Yeah, not into it. But to your point though, I mean, this documentary is 84 minutes long and you know, brevity is probably it's in the best interest of something of this. But I do feel like you probably had about 10 minutes of wiggle room where you could have injected a little bit more of a groundedness to it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause at times it just felt like there was a little bit of like, look at how kooky these fans are, mm-hmm. which is a bummer because
yeah.
I, to your point with that story of this woman dealing with, you know, these shows and these fandoms are, it can be a lifeline for a lot of people. You know, I don't know about you guys, but you know, when I'm in a shitty headspace, I have shows that I put on that just make me feel better. Mm-hmm. It's just like they're
Star
your
Trek
friends. And
yeah.
that's
Star Trek for me,
you know,
as well.
So
yeah.
I totally get that.
No, yeah. And like that again goes with like, it kind of jumps from topic to topic without yes. a natural progression. And yeah. I started wondering if they were going to go almost chronologically because they do a lot of the original series mm-hmm. cast at the start. And then they just kind of all
I agree
like yeah and I was curious if we'd be getting more stories like that and just how the fandom has progressed and how mm-hmm. like a generation grew up with the original series and then brought their kids or their families mm-hmm. into mm-hmm. it and how the next generation affected people like that and yeah. how like these people that grew up started to affect not just like their families and friends through Star Trek but like the world around them.
Mm-hmm. There's also just a lot of groundbreaking stuff that the show did in some of its casting. I mean, mm-hmm. in casting,
oh, yeah.
You know, a black lead for Deep Space Nine and then for casting a woman. Like, these were all things that were a pretty big deal at the time, certainly within the Star Trek universe, but also just within television as a whole. And you don't really sense that either. Like, to your point, the spine of the series really should have been the spine of the documentary, of sort of the chronological history of what the show was capable of doing you don't really feel that.
Yeah.
Like, they right. don't really talk about Deep Space Nine really at all.
No.
They kind of just disregarded
it. My favorite, so I was kind of...
I think it's a lot of people's favorites.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it does
yeah.
feel like, at the time, people were like, wait, so the station just stays there the whole time?
Which yeah. is fine, because adventure comes to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think time...
That was the tagline, right? Adventure
yes.
comes
yeah.
to us?
Adventure comes to them.
I think time has been and will continue to be very kind to Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was weird that in the documentary, it really just breezes right by, and even then, the brief bit of filming Deep Space Nine they show
yeah.
is almost more focused on LeVar Burton directing it than it is
yes.
the actual filming of it, because you don't even get to talk to the cast members mm-hmm. there. It just is LeVar Burton talking about it. And then they spent a pretty fair amount of time with Voyager. And like,
well, with Janeway at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And to your point, I thought it was very cool when they did talk about like how a lot of like moms were bringing their kids into it just as like a strong female role model and everything. Like I thought that was really cool.
Yeah. I mean, these are all things that I feel like they could have underlined a little better. Like
yes.
they're all there and we were looking for it mm. because we were trying to find mm-hmm. a little bit more meat and substance to it.
Well, and back to like the history of the show, there's also the history of Star Trek Phantom mm-hmm. where I'm going to mince my words. Is that the phrase? Mince
sure.
my words?
Sure.
Mince my meat?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But fandom back in the 60s, when the original series first started, fandom was responsible for keeping that show on the mm-hmm. air. Mm-hmm. There was a writing campaign. Mm-hmm. There were, you know, these small conventions, mostly led by women, who were like, we really love this show and Star Trek lives and, you know, we want to keep the history of it and keep it on the air. And so it was a fan campaign at first. And then the fandom grew into these conventions where it was about the merchandise and selling things and meeting people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now it's kind of blossomed where the franchise itself is very much involved with the fandom in, you know, there's the Star Trek cruise that just docked in the Bahamas.
How many people have coronavirus on
Who knows?
On that cruise.
But now, you know, it's just kind of the, I guess I was wishing this documentary had kind of covered a little bit more of that history and the changing of fandom over the years.
You kind of almost want Trekkies 3, for being completely honest, where we can kind of, I mean, as you know, you're a part of this new sort of whatever you want to call it.
I went to my first Star Trek Las Vegas convention last fall.
That sounds incredible.
It was.
But this is sort of, I think it'd be interesting for someone to explore this fandom now. Mm-hmm. As it's evolved, as it's changed, as this IP has continued to evolve and change, and as fandom just in general has changed, I think it'd be interesting to sort of to do that. But I mean, who knows? And then they can talk about what's his face? Why can't I think of his name from Quantum Leap? Scott Bakula as an Enterprise
Captain Archer. Mm-hmm. That's a
show that doesn't really exist, right, guys? Can we? We can. That show doesn't really exist, right? I mean, it does.
It does.
But it doesn't. Does anyone talk about Enterprise?
They talk about the theme song. Apparently, if you... I've actually been doing this because there's that whole, like, sing happy birthday while you wash your hands to avoid coronavirus.
Yeah. Or it's the end of the world as we know it.
Yes. Someone realized that you can sing the first half of the theme to Star Trek Enterprise and...
we're all ears.
It's been a long road getting from here to there. It's been a long time.
Wait, there are lyrics?
Yeah, it's the only Star Trek theme song that has lyrics. It's like a pop rock song, kind of.
Oh, boy, I didn't know that.
But weirdly, recently, like, what was this, a few days ago, we saw on Twitter, someone put that over the Deep Space Nine opening, and it actually kind of works there.
I just remember that show feeling a little bit like... I don't know what the best way to... It felt like the series had sort of... moved on and that people didn't really care as much about Star Trek as they used to. And this was like one more attempt to kind of get people to care. And it didn't so much work.
It was one of those things too, where it was Star Trek, TNG, Deep Space Nine, Voyager was all syndicated and Enterprise was kind of the return, right? Was it on?
Yeah, right. It was on UPN, right?
Yeah. But it kind of felt like more like, UPN, the channel of Buffy and all the cool kids are watching this. And then suddenly it was like, I was like, oh yeah, I love Star Trek. Oh, I'm going to be judged for loving this Star Trek.
Right.
Well, it also felt like they tried to be like, this isn't your mama's Star Trek, you know?
And I love my mama's Star Trek.
That's the thing. I think Star Trek is something that I think is kind of resistant to like trying to make it edgier or hardcore, quote unquote, in that like the earnestness is kind of the appeal, at least to the people that, you know, Star Trek is maybe never going to have the broadest appeal. Yeah. I think it did have a more broad appeal than we might have like understood in the 90s.
Yes. Those movies were big.
Yeah, they were pretty big. Yeah. And like, I remember, it's funny, like I took for granted, I guess, when I was a kid, and it just like watching this documentary made me realize like I was a pretty big Trekkie in elementary school. And like my friends were kind of on board, you know, like I would go to comic book stores with my friends and buy like Star Trek action figures. And my friends would just like do it with me. And there wasn't like really the same sort of stigma, at least among kids, even though I think there's this prevailing notion that like, you know, Star Trek of all the fandoms is kind of like you're the nerdiest, you know, you are you are the most socially awkward. But I think some of that goes back to like the stuff we see in this documentary. Like that was just the perception for a very long time.
How did you guys how did Star Trek come into your lives?
My mom.
Yeah, my I watched the
I don't know why I said it so weird.
Okay.
No, it was you know, my parents, mostly my mom, loved TNG, loved Deep Space Nine. When we were living in Saudi Arabia, my uncle, who was also a big fan, he would record tapes of them and send them to us so that we had.
So the movies or mostly the shows?
Mostly the shows. Okay. Yeah.
Because I vaguely remember for me anyway, they were movies that I think they were safe for kids to watch because there wasn't anything in them that was particularly gory or scary. They're basically kind of Star Warsy in that respect.
Yeah.
I remember my mom taking me to see Voyage Home. That was probably one of the first movies that
I saw. Great movie.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Wales, right?
Yeah, like yeah. I grew up on TNG. Similarly, like my parents watched it, and it was a it was like a very family
Okay.
It was our family show.
Same with the movies, or mostly the show.
I was about to say the movies also. Like I got into the movies through that.
Okay.
And like I think yeah, the Voyage Home was the first one I saw. And it was kind of like a thing that unified the entire family. Yeah. Like, despite all of our varied tastes, we could always watch Star Trek, the show, and The Voyage Home was a really big thing. And similarly, to your point, like, even though, you know, it's like Star Trek, which is a little more adult than a lot of other sci-fi, like, in terms of just like, you know, it's a bit more heady and intellectual at times. Like, Voyage Home is a movie that I watched as a kid all the time and just thought was really funny.
I haven't seen it in a long time, guys. Does it hold up?
Oh, it does.
Okay. It holds up great.
Yeah. It holds up still great. An 80s movie, but yeah.
Oh, it's absolutely an 80s movie. It's also like the most, it very much marches to the beat of its own drum amongst all the Star Trek movies. Like it's very, you know, it at one point in the development, I believe it was supposed to star Eddie Murphy.
Because
he was a big Star Trek fan, and it, you know, it's about them traveling back in time to San Francisco to save some humpback whales to bring to the future, so they can save the world.
That old chestnut.
And I believe at one point it was because Paramount was looking, and they were like, "Well, Star Trek is a big franchise for us, and Beverly Hills Cop is a big franchise for us." And I believe that was the genesis of like you know sending the crew of the Enterprise back in time.
That's really it's interesting. So this feels like a good segue to talk about the movies for a bit, because I do feel like the movies, there's this weird theory that like the odd numbers are bad, the even numbers are good. But I think Nemesis kind of sticks its thumb in the eye of that theory.
Yeah, Nemesis broke that. So, at least for a little while.
But, which actually, just going back to the documentary, how funny it was that the kid,
Gabriel,
yeah, Gabriel was making this movie called Star Trek Nemesis the documentary. Yeah.
I also thought that was another thing going back. Like they kind of breeze by the fact that he's making a fan film and with friends, and they're like making these elaborate costumes, and he's like designing these elaborate 3D models of ships in there.
His
and I was like, this is so
incredible.
Cool.
I know.
Yeah,
and they breeze past it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. They breeze past a lot of stuff in this. But
listen, we want a 6-part HBO documentary series on
I
this.
I would be there for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, why isn't that happening?
One episode all about Mistress Janeway and the Tasha Yar Data erotic fan art.
Those pictures were, I mean, to be fair, we got some Ichabod and Abby art sent our way.
What was the name? It was
Ichabod. It got weird. Mm-hmm. Like it definitely, you were just like, I get it. You want these two to bone. Like, anyway, but so the first movie, kind of not good, right?
I enjoy it.
Oh, yeah, Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Yes, the Motion Picture.
It's you know, it's an acquired taste. It's extraordinarily slow. It's not
it's
so much really
gorgeous.
Boring.
It is gorgeous.
It's pretty to look at.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that like you know the movie happened because they looked at Star Wars, which was recently such a big success, and then
in 2001, right?
Yeah, 2001 before. Yeah. But I think it's interesting that like they make this movie not that long after Star Wars, and instead of going after that trend, they're like, "Nah, we're gonna
slow that shit down.
Yeah, we're gonna slow that shit down. Put in a weird synth score. Spock is gonna go through a black hole, sort of, but not really. And he, like he just does have like the wormhole moment from 2001, and then Spock comes out, you know, and Spock spends the first half of the movie like away from Starfleet and on a vision quest, and you know,
is there a villain in it? I don't even really remember.
Well, it's V'ger,
yeah,
which is it's Voyager. It's all it has to do with like the Carl Sagan.
Okay. Yeah, no, the villain quote. It's not really a villain, but it's like this massive entity that's sort of like a big cloud of space garbage and stuff that is destroying everything in its path. And you find out
trying to find its maker,
and it's coming back towards Earth, which is why the Enterprise is tasked to intercept it. And what you find out is that the Voyager probe, in the what like 300 years since it was sent out, gained sentience somewhere in the universe and is just kind of confused, looking to get back to its creators. It's really fascinating.
What's amazing is that could actually happen.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that I think is, because I'm sort of just kind of going through the series in my head a little bit and just thinking about how the movies that tended to work had a villain, like a person or an alien of some sort.
Well, First Contact, I mean, it's Borg Queen, but it's kind of still a little bit of that nebulous.
A little bit, but that's still like the my point is that it gets witchy when it gets a little bit ambiguous and intangible, like cloud of space garbage coming to kill Earth, or even in Search for Spock, right? Where it's like, what I don't know what that I know what that movie's about literally, but like yeah.
it's in the title.
It's in the title. Spoiler: they yeah. find him. But like it's whereas like Khan, which is held up as the best or mm-hmm. one of the best, yeah. has like a villain and we understand it, mm-hmm. and or a tactile mission of some sort that makes sense. It's when they get a little too heady that I feel like sometimes they lose people, mm-hmm. and those movies tend to be less like The Final Frontier. I don't know what the fuck's going on in The Final Frontier.
Oh, it's rough.
It's God? Is it God?
It's yeah. sort of God. What does God need with a starship?
You could do a better impression. Yes, you can.
Not on the spot.
But it's but you understand what I'm getting at, right? Like that's why it feels like it ping pongs between these two ideas. Of it's got a pretty great rogues gallery of like people to go up against when you think about it.
Yeah, I'd say to your point, yeah, the it's maybe less like a specific villain and more like a more mission specific, driven and focused thing. Because like the Voyage Home doesn't really have, you know, there's no villain in it. I mean the probe is right. like, but it's just a thing that's destroying the Earth in the future.
But people just like seeing them on Earth because it was funny.
No, exactly.
They're just like, oh look.
But yeah, to your point,
he has to cover his ears because they're pointy.
Look, there's bikers.
Yeah. Stuff like that. But yeah, and then like, yeah, Star Trek 2 obviously has Khan. Star Trek 6 has like this amazing Christopher Plummer performance.
Fantastic.
Like, it's so cool.
That movie is one of the more underrated ones. I feel like that's a movie that people don't give, in the series anyway, don't give enough love.
I think it's like, it's got its like strong fans. It's also telling that that's the one that Nick Meyer came back for in full. Mm-hmm. Nick Meyer, who wrote and directed The Wrath of Khan.
Right. It also, I remember I saw that in the theater. I remember all that... weightlessness, purple blood stuff.
Oh, that's great.
Is awesome. Mm-hmm. The morphing stuff too that they mm-hmm. did. Like it was a like surprisingly cool movie.
Yeah.
And then is First Contact the only good one with the Next Generation cast?
Yeah.
Like Generations.
So resigned.
Yeah, Generations should be really good.
It has Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah, Malcolm McDowell is the bad guy. Like the TNG cast is so good.
They are
just very effortless together. Yeah. And like you get, you know, Captain Kirk and Captain Picard together should be a really great moment. Like I remember as a kid, like just watching, this is like when I was getting into real like movie fandom and like seeing on Entertainment Tonight, like clips of William Shatner and Patrick Stewart together and it just being like a moment and me losing my mind. And then you see the movie.
Also, don't forget, we get Succession's own Alan Ruck.
That's true.
I forgot about that. Yeah,
he's the
captain of the Enterprise B, right?
Yes, I think he was in Ferris Bueller before he was in Succession.
He? He was also the star of The Exorcist on Fox.
And Spin City.
And he's in Speed. Let's just keep going.
Let's just keep talking about Alan Ruck. But yeah, it is interesting what you're saying that like I remember Generations. I remember that being a moment. I remember the passing of the baton. I remember it being a big deal that Kirk died and his last words were not great, but they are what they are. And then First Contact comes out, which was a big deal. I remember that was a very successful movie. I remember they went all in with the Borg, which made total sense considering the series, and it worked.
Yeah.
And then it stopped for like Insurrection. I don't remember anything about Insurrection.
It's not very good. There's a really interesting book that Michael
James
Piller,
Cromwell in Insurrection? Is he the guy?
Cromwell is
Cromwell's
First Contact.
Yeah, it's F. Murray Abraham's in it,
right?
Right. Has like a face stretchy alien, and it's the Fountain of Youth planet.
Yeah.
But that's the one that the Michael Piller book is about, right? Right?
Yes.
Insurrection?
Yes.
Yeah, like Michael Piller, who is basically like the showrunner that brought Next Generation back from the brink of when it was really bad in seasons 1 and 2, and then kind of set the template that begat the other shows. And like so many TV writers, like, you know, some of the guys on Elementary, like learned under his sort of model in the Star Trek shows. He has a book that was never published, but you can find it online.
Because his wife is like, I'd like his words to matter, even if Paramount wants to silence him.
Yeah, he died not long after, so it's kind of like the last thing from Michael Piller. But it's this book about, and it's a pretty like unfiltered look at like the writing of Star Trek Insurrection and how it started as one cool idea, and then it's like, well, you need to service all these masters, you need to service these actors, which by that point, like Patrick Stewart and I think Brent Spiner had a pretty considerable amount of say in how it goes. You know, we can keep going.
I think it's a really fascinating series. You know, you have the Next Generation movies, you have Nemesis, which kind of puts a stake in it. It feels like that's sort of the end. And then.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, I don't know how it came to be. I don't know how the 2009 J.J., Bob and Alex, Damon Lindelof movie happened, but it infused an excitement in me and in obviously a fair amount of people that went to see that movie that this was a brand that was worth exploring again. But then the second movie stumbles. The con stuff just doesn't really work, at least in my humble opinion. There's a lot of good stuff in it, but it also just feels like they're kind of putting, it's kind of a kitchen sink movie. Like they put so much stuff into that and it doesn't all kind of jive with itself. And
then I think the worst part about the second
Into Darkness
is that it was filming at CIA where I worked. And that's so I went to see that movie and I was like, that's where I fucking work all day. And I don't
want to see it.
Seeing my place of work in entertainment.
It's fair. Yeah. I remember when we were doing Sleepy Hollow, I was writing an episode and I titled it Into Darkness and they said no.
Oh.
Really?
I was just being playful. I wasn't shitting on their movie. But that being said, I think that there's something to be said for sort of the for the series and where it was sort of going and what they were doing. And I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff in all of it. I think that Beyond has some interesting stuff in it too. It just all kind of feels like it's ping ponging against each other and isn't fully coming into focus. But I'm curious to see if Paramount keeps going, like what they do moving forward.
Yeah. Cause they're due to make another one, right?
I mean, there's the Tarantino thing, which
I heard that's
is
done,
that dead?
Right?
Okay, I don't know. Done. And then there was talk of a Chris Hemsworth, Chris Pine thing where like they play with time and the father and son get to meet in some way or another, but it was a budgetary thing.
I think that one's also done. And the Noah Hawley one is the one that's
right. Yes. So he's, but with perhaps a new cast. Yeah, it's anyone's guess.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's just so interesting too. Cause like to your point, when you look back at the arc of these movies, there are so many high points and so many points that are kind of low. And like so much of Star Trek, like the high points are kind of a response to the low points. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, for example, Wrath of Khan is like a really, it's kind of a small movie. You know, it takes place like in the bridges of the two ships primarily, which are actually the same set, just like moved around. Like the panels were all moved around.
Sure.
Like Ricardo Montalban and William Shatner weren't even there the same day. It's just to say like it was a movie that was made kind of like on a shoestring budget relatively. Yeah. And it works. And then the next time they try to go bigger and it doesn't work. Yeah, and then the time after that it's kind of like
each successive movie
is like a response to the one before it. Yeah. And you know, it's kind of like, that's why it's this weird, like ping pong.
Here's a question, a next generation question.
I'm ready.
Could they just do a younger version of that cast?
Well, I mean, the first episode of Next Generation is the crew assembling.
All coming together.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then that doesn't work. Because there's just a part of me that was thinking, like, because a lot of people feel like the 2009 movie is sort of like Muppet Baby Star Trek, which is which is fine. Yeah. And I love Muppet Babies and I like that movie.
I want a Muppet Babies in space.
God, that would be so great.
Guys.
Do you remember that Gonzo's an Alien? Do you remember that movie?
Yeah. Oh, well, Muppets go to space.
Oh.
I believe they do it in 1999, in fact.
Oh, wow. So
we will be covering
that.
It's fantastic. I don't think it's one of the better Muppet movies, but I don't know. We'll talk about it. We're gonna find out.
But yeah, to your point of like, if there's a younger version of that cast,
I wonder if there's something to be done with that. Yeah. Because to me, it's like, if you can't get this cast and you're rebooting it all over again, it's a big cast and it's a lot of roles to fill with, and it's tough to fill those roles. Is there a way to pivot? Is it a whole new thing? I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder about that. And like newer Star Trek, especially like since 2009, you find that it's very the new stuff is generally tethered to something of the old stuff. Like, you know, Discovery is sort of like set in a very specific place in the timeline or in relation to the original series. Picard is obviously, you know, set in relation to the Next Generation. And I think that's really interesting because at least in the 90s, like each new Star Trek show was very much its own thing and had like kind of a tangential at best relation to anything else. Like Deep Space Nine is sort of born out of a storyline in the Next Generation, but then that's the end of it. And then Deep Space Nine is its own thing. And like,
and Voyager too has the Maquis storyline that sets it off, but it doesn't have anything to do with Deep Space after that.
And the Next Generation, like the name of the ship is the same. And Bones McCoy shows up in one of the early episodes as like a 130-year-old man.
It's funny when you said earlier about how like, you know, Khan was made on a shoestring budget. There's a part of me that kind of wants to see someone make a Star Trek movie on $50 million. Something like that. Like, and I know that that's not a shoestring budget, but I just mean like something that constricts it and sort of puts it in a different headspace would be interesting. I like Noah Hawley. I think he's I love Fargo. There was a lot of stuff in Legion I thought was really interesting. Like, I think he's a really interesting guy. I'll be curious to see what he does with him. But so someone who does appear in this documentary is Brandon Braga, shows up in his leather jacket.
Oh, can we talk about the lamp?
I didn't notice the lamp.
The lamp is in the form of a naked woman's torso. And that is the lamp he chose to have as showrunner in his office. He could have had any lamp in the world, and that's the one he chose.
Prominently featured in his talking head segments.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know Brandon Braga from Adam, but I'll say that there is something about the way he comports himself a little bit in this that is a little bit not great. Like, there's a little bit of like looking down on the people that want to be on the show, wearing his leather jacket with his lady torso behind him. There's a lot of a little bit of bravado going on. But it's interesting nonetheless to get a perspective of a person who's showrunning a Star Trek show at the time.
Yeah.
What that must have been like. Because it's interesting because Brian Fuller's talked about this as well. Because he, his first writing credit, I believe, is on Voyager, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
He was a huge Star Trek fan, is a huge Star Trek fan. And that you could submit scripts to Star Trek back in the day, right?
Yeah, it's how Gene Espenson got her start.
Crazy.
Ron Moore, who became like a major Star Trek writer, and then obviously Battlestar Galactica. My old boss from elementary, Rob Doherty, came up through Voyager that way. Those were his first scripts. I was really surprised, actually, in the documentary that they, you know, he Brandon Braga mentions this policy and then just goes into talking about how some fan sends them a piece of mail every week when, like, it's a really cool thing, and a lot of like notable writers got their start because of blind submissions. Yep. A lot of the like Yesterday's Enterprise, which we were just talking about, was a blind submission, like that then became one of the most notable episodes of Next Generation. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I thought like
he was a little derisive. He seemed dismissive of that, I guess is the better way of putting it.
Yes.
Which is a bummer. And I don't believe any show can do that anymore.
Like, no,
from WGA regulations being what they are?
I don't even know if it's a WGA thing.
I think it's less a WGA thing, and it's more like it is a gigantic legal, like, you know, like vulnerability.
That's, okay, fair enough.
Like, yeah, I don't know how it went for Trek. I don't know if they got sued a lot or anything.
But I mean, back to fandom, like, any of these people who are submitting these ideas and these scripts were fans first, writers second.
Yeah.
And just kind of like it really didn't dive into what it means to, especially for, I mean, the three of us too, growing up as fans of stuff and now writing, like, there is a path. And unfortunately, that wasn't explored in this documentary.
Yeah, it's... It does feel like there were a lot of paths not taken with this documentary. Part of it, I think, is because it's a pretty big world to kind of wrap your arms around the whole thing.
It's so broad, and there are like three or four more specific and focused angles you clearly could have taken.
Right.
Like, you know, one about the script submissions, one about like the erotic fiction, you know, one about like the merchandising, one about like people who walked around in cosplay all the time.
Well, that's why, to your point, like, I know you were kind of joking and kind of not about an HBO series that's, you know, six or eight episodes long. You could break it into an episode of each thing and really be able to kind of hone in on what's so wonderful about this franchise, or quite frankly, there's a lot of franchises you could do it with, but this one in particular, because of its straddling movies and television, could be a lot more interesting to explore. But that idea of, you know, being a fan of the, like, I was not a fan of Star Trek to the same degree, so I would not have sat down and written a spec episode of Star Trek. It would not have made sense for me to do that. But I gladly would have done it for like Six Feet Under or The West Wing or any number of shows that I loved when I was, you know, a teenager or whatever. Mm-hmm. And even in my early 20s, if I could have sat down and written an episode and sent it into a show, I mean, that's an unbelievable thing. And it's a bummer that they don't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's interesting to have him talk about that a little bit. I don't really know Brannon's trajectory, so I don't know how he got on the show. So I'm assuming it's not through this channel, but it's just it's interesting.
Yeah, I can't remember how he joined. I just listened to the 50-year mission, which if you want a real deep dive into Star Trek,
yeah, I bet.
That is two volumes. Each volume is about 30 hours on Audible, and it is fantastic. It is a great deep dive, but it's less about fandom and more about the making of the series.
Yeah. Fandom comes about when you get, because it's all, you know, talking heads. It's all, you know, bits from interviews, and some of the writers talk about exactly what we've been talking about, how they started as fans as kids, and then they grew up and they found out you could story, you know,
right. So let's talk about Spiner Femmes for a second.
Yes, please.
So Spiner Femmes, for people who have not watched the documentary, there's a lady whose name unfortunately I didn't catch, maybe you did, Sean. But she apparently I'm not convinced there are more than one. It seems singular to me.
Yeah, couldn't find like a Reddit subreddit.
I don't know that there's any other Spiner Femmes. It feels like it's just her.
Yeah.
Singular. Yes.
I don't know. There were other people that did send Denise Crosby erotic fan art of her, of Tasha Yar, and Lieutenant Commander Data a variety of positions that were just wow.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
So this lady shows. She's got binders filled with just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos of Brent Spiner at Brett or Brent?
Brent. Binders in a locked safe she keeps in her closet, mind you.
Right.
Yeah.
Of him at a bunch of different conventions, I'm assuming.
I did love the one photo that was, she was like, and that's my back as I was presenting him the gift of the Texas stamp.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
He's from Texas.
Because he's from Texas. And then it cuts to Brent Spiner and he says like, yeah, you know, I tell them they don't need to give me gifts. Like they should use their money elsewhere. I do okay. And then it cuts back to her and I wrote this down. She says like, it's not about the money. It's about, you know, it's like, it's about giving him, like, I found that so fascinating. And yeah, like there was that one part of the binder where it's like it was a photo every second of the
that's what
panel,
I was gonna say.
Right?
It like, literally could have been a fucking flip book. Like it's just him in various positions. It was just crazy.
I did love when she went out to her balcony and was talking about how that's the hill that he lives somewhere on. And she couldn't see his specific house, but she could kind of imagine that it would be there.
Yeah,
and
Brent Breaks?
Brent Breaks! That's what she called it. She
that
wanted
made me
to
really
take
sad.
A Brent break. And she was
really
holding
sad.
Her crying child.
Child? Yeah. I was just like, lady.
Damn.
You... Oh boy. It's just sad. It makes me sad. She makes me a little bit sad.
But it's like, I mean, we all have our fantasies. We all enjoy things. And it's to varying degrees. And this documentary shows a very specific degree.
Yes, a very specific degree.
Yeah.
When she was asked about Trekkers or Trekkies, she's like, I think there's a negative connotation to both of those. I prefer Spiner Femmes. Just like, sure. That's not a thing.
Spiner Femmes. I mean,
by the way,
it makes sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah. But I mean, going back to money and stuff, there was that one moment where they had the auction for the Klingon face piece. And I think it was like $1,600 that one Klingon ended up paying for a prop. And not a good prop, in my opinion.
Yeah, it was like latex that was clearly
rotting.
Aging. But it was cool that like you could see the fans in the audience going back and forth in this auction. Yeah. And the one guy in full Klingon garb gets it, and they go up to him afterwards and they ask, and he says like, I wouldn't have left without it. Like he was gonna pay whatever it took. And I just thought like that was kind of cool, even though it was like you know, that thing is gonna look just like a nondescript piece of rubber.
There was
in like
an
6 weeks.
Auction last summer for some of the Deep Space Nine costumes, and I was looking at it because I was just kind of curious how much some of this stuff went for, and it was like Quark's whole wardrobe. And, you know, it was, you know, several hundred dollars. And I was like, but who and why? Because Armin Shimerman is a very specific height. Yeah. Who's going to fit into this? Are you going to put it on a mannequin? Is this something you put in your house as visitors walk by? I don't know.
That's the thing people do. Like, they'll buy notable costumes and just put them on mannequins. And...
Is that what we're going to do?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's a
that's Ernie, by the way, laughing in the background. Yeah.
It's a thing people do, Emmy. Lots of people.
It's true. Here's the thing. I because in my head I was sort of trying to work out, like, people that take props from shows they worked on or shows that they created or whatever the case might be. There's a personal attachment to that thing, whatever it is. And I can't necessarily say that it's drastically dissimilar to the attachment that a fan would have to that thing, other than the fact that they were a part of the actual production and this fan has sort of just projected, and not wrongly, just an attachment to that thing. So I sort of understand it. I guess it depends on the props. Personally speaking, for me, like, costumes and makeup stuff, I find kind of gross.
Yeah.
Just because it's like people are like wearing them and sweating in them and like it's just kind of gross. Whereas like a physical prop of some sort, like, for instance, I really wanted to get the head from Sleepy Hollow. Oh. Ultimately, I wasn't able to, but that doesn't matter. But like, that's a thing that I'm like, yeah, that's a cool thing to put on your desk that I sort of understand. A piece of rotting latex that was on random Klingon's head for a scene, to me, is not worth that kind of money. But teach their own. No judgment.
I think that goes back again to, like, it was 1999. Like, genre material was not quite as ubiquitous and widespread. Yes, and, like, this was, like, a huge thing and people grew up with it. So, like, I can understand why, like, you know, in an environment that's a little more dry for this material, like, that meant a lot to somebody.
Totally.
You know? And, like,
totally.
You know, he's getting dressed up in Klingon garb, you know, to go hang out with his friends at a convention. I'm sure to him it doesn't even matter if in 3 weeks it just doesn't look like it was when he got it. Like, it's just knowing what it was.
I agree with that. So Starbase Dental.
Yes. I actually just went to my dentist right before we watched this, and I am so thankful that it is just a normal dentist office. Yeah.
It makes me question the legitimacy of the dentistry.
I mean, I found the Yelp review. Yes, I sent it to you.
I know, it's fantastic.
But, I mean, I feel like I've been going to a bunch of doctors for, like, check-ins and stuff, and every single doctor's office I do go to, they have weird art. My podiatrist, the guy who's helping my ankle, like, there's just a bunch of shoe art on the walls. There's actual shoes.
That's on point.
Yeah, but it's like, I feel like a lot of doctors' office, no matter what, they're just weird looking. They put up a lot of weird stuff. And so
dentists and doctors, generally speaking, don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They want, the only thing that I care to see on their walls is their diplomas. I don't need to see anything else.
From Starfleet Academy.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. So Starfleet Dental, or Starbase Dental, my apologies, was fun to watch. Would never actually have them do anything to my teeth.
Yeah, I'd like show up and buy floss. I wouldn't, you know, like, I would go. I would check it out. Then, like, you know, the second they're like about to, you know, put me under to take out my wisdom teeth, it's like, oh, I gotta go.
There was that one standee of Dr. Bashir.
That was amazing.
Just was a weird look.
Yep. Well, it was a weird look because it looks like he's in the back of the room taking notes. Yeah. Like he's a doctor, like, you know, inspecting your procedure. Yeah. I'm trying to think of some of the other, like,
well, the first time that we see them. Mm-hmm.
Is as a family.
Yeah. And the daughter is not happy about it.
I want a follow-up interview with her.
She was like, I fucking hate these people. I can't believe they're making me wear this. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. She looked so despondent.
Yeah. Yeah, she was clearly not into it. The husband and wife, they talked about, like, how they would add on different roles. Yeah, how they would, like, switch up their costumes and their personas.
And very specifically that she would be Data and he would be Tasha.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Because she's too short.
Ugh.
It's weird.
A choice.
It was weird. The way that they even just eyed each other while in the uniforms and in the costumes, while on camera.
They were hungry.
You're both way too thirsty for this right now. Like, what's happening?
Yep.
But I love them, and I hope that they're happy. It's a very strange...
Also,
working environment.
The one woman who was like, I really didn't feel comfortable wearing the costume, and it took me over a year of being berated by my boss to put on a Starfleet.
He told me
uniform.
I had to.
Yeah,
she would cry.
Wild.
It's insane.
Yeah, I hope she has her own dental practice now. That's just a normal
I do too.
Office.
That's a real fucking dentist's office.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's even just like them interviewing the patients in the waiting room. Mm-hmm. Just like,
well, they interview the dentist when he's like doing a procedure on somebody, and I was like, what the hell
is
like,
happening?
Why in the world does that person even know? Like, you know, are they under? Do they not know this is happening? Like,
yeah, I didn't really know what to make of. Because there's some stuff that's just like set up, right? Like that's a documentary and they're like, we're going to show up at your thing. Mm-hmm. And like, can we talk to your patients? And will you sign a waiver to be like, I get it, but it still felt like weirdly stilted at times. And the patients in particular in the waiting room where he comes out, he's like, hey, come on in. Let's go. It was weird, but I enjoyed it.
Really just interesting stuff, you know, like
really, really interesting stuff.
Yeah. I agree. Well, and like specifically because Star Trek has so many interesting teeth, they never mm-hmm. went into that.
Very that's good point.
That is a good point.
It's a very good point.
Thank you.
Does anybody go in there and ask to get like Klingon teeth?
Yeah. Oh, get some chiseled.
Yeah.
Chiseled
sharpened
fangs. Oh yeah.
Romulans and Klingons. Aesthetically, how different do they look? Because I don't
wildly
very much so.
Romulan is more Vulcan-esque.
Oh right. Okay. Yeah. So what's his face from Nero?
Oh,
Romulan?
Eric Bana. In one of his hottest roles ever.
Sure. Kind of a forgettable villain, but sure.
Oh, no.
He's fine.
No, he's great. He's fantastic.
He's pretty cool.
I stand for Eric Bana. I actually rewatched Troy the other day for him. He's great in it.
I caught a little bit of Hulk last night on HBO. I mean, love Hulk, obviously.
Great movie.
That movie is edited psychotically, and I love every second of it.
Oh, yeah.
I want him back. Where did he go?
Eric Bana?
He was in
Dirty John,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he was in Dirty John.
Okay.
He's a guy who's had such a weird career within a few years, he was in Star Trek mm-hmm. as Nero, as this, like, you know, grunting, hulking mm-hmm. villain. And then, like, right after that, or maybe a few years later, he was in Funny People.
It's the same year.
Oh, it was the same year?
2009.
Oh, whoa, okay. 2009 came at you fast,
it's a,
I guess.
It's a weird thing.
But yeah, and like in that, he's basically like kind of himself because he has the Australian accent mm-hmm. and he's this like, you know, big, like just like energetic guy. He's like,
yeah, I'm looking up Eric Bana for a second.
He's really funny.
Bana,
too.
Bana or Bana?
I think it's Bana.
Bana?
I mispronounced it.
But he's just like, I don't know. There was an era where a lot of people were casting him as like a Hot Topic goth.
So he comes off of Chopper, which was a big movie. Ooh, where he played. He plays some
big
sort
movie
of
in Australia,
an Australian movie where he plays this like serial killer or something like that. And then he gets Black Hawk Down, which kind of puts him on the map
fantastic.
A little bit. Then he's the voice in Finding Nemo.
Who?
I believe he's the shark or one of the sharks.
Oh, maybe.
Then he gets Hulk and everyone thinks like he's going to be the next big thing. He does Hulk, Troy, Munich.
Oh, and you know what it is? It's the sex scene in Munich that destroys
him. Yeah, it's one of the problems.
Oh, gosh.
Ooh. Yeah, don't give Spielberg sex scenes.
I don't actually agree with that. Don't give sweaty slow motion sex scenes to Spielberg. I thought the sexy. He's not a sexy filmmaker, just to be very clear.
No.
But like, there's sex scenes weirdly in Schindler's List that are kind of fine. Just for what that's worth.
I'm just going to
follow up on that.
I'm just, that was amazing. But I'm just saying, he can direct a normal sex scene. There's actually another sex scene in Munich that's fine. It's the last one that's the problem. Because it's cross cut with the murders of the people.
Mm-hmm. And it's wet. Weird.
It's insane.
Yeah.
I'm not writing for the sex scene in Munich. And then he does Lucky You. Remember that movie with Drew Barrymore that what's-his-face directed? Curtis Hanson did?
Sure.
Anyway, that was a movie.
That sounds like a thing that
happened. That was a movie that happened.
Okay.
And then in 09, he has Star Trek and Funny People and Time Traveler's Wife all in the same year. And those are three very different movies.
Yeah.
And they're all good movies. Like, I don't have a problem really with any of them. Time Traveler's Wife is fine, but whatever. Then he's in Hannah.
Yes.
He's great in Hannah. Yeah. Lone Survivor. And then that's kind of the end of it. That's
bring John. Eric Bana back.
Yeah.
We miss you, Eric.
BBB.
Yeah.
Bring Bana back.
Yep.
Bana back.
Back to Star Trek.
Back to Star Trek. Here's a question. And this made me think of Galaxy Quest a little bit because obviously Galaxy Quest is modeled after Star Trek and the Tim Allen character obviously is modeled after the Shatner character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think,
well, not even the Shatner character, just Shatner.
Shatner, human being.
Shatner's a weird thing with Star Trek, if you ask me, because there's a part of me that feels like he has a love for it because it obviously birthed his career and it's he is who he is because of Star Trek. But there's also a little bit of a touch or twinge of resentment that you feel a little bit toward. Not resentment might be the wrong word. Sort of this like looking down at some of the fans sometimes.
Yeah, I.
There's that famous quote from him at some convention where he's like, "You people need to get a life" or something like that. Like he's just.
I wonder if that's also, I feel like in the last couple of years that maybe has waned and he has started a little bit of like what Carrie Fisher would talk about with Princess Leia of like, mm-hmm. yeah, it's unfortunate that, you know.
All I'll be remembered for is Princess Leia.
Exactly. But also kind of realizing that like that's they're so intertwined.
Yeah.
And I feel like he shows up to these conventions. Like he does one man, mm-hmm. you know, panels where he talks with the fans. He was on the cruise this past week. So he still
He's
very deeply involved with fandom. But I think
he's got to pay for that horse semen somehow.
have
you heard about this?
No, I have not.
Somewhere, yeah, I did.
No,
so
I have
him
not.
And his wife, I guess there's some divorce that he's going through or something like that, and he was allowed to keep the horse semen that they have for, I guess, breeding horses, I'm assuming.
Wow.
So that's it was worth it for the reaction that it got from that meme. But anyway. Yeah. It doesn't pay for itself.
Anyway. Yeah, okay, okay.
No, but like back on tech because
we need to go there.
No, like Shatner's a really interesting figure in the fandom too, because like in the, you get a little bit of it in this where it's like you see the original series cast all talking about their memories, you know, like George Takei talks about going to NASA with Nichelle Nichols and you know, kind of the elephant in the room is that like they all have longer interviews where they go into detail and the only appearance of Shatner in the documentary was taken while he was at some charity event. And it's not even so much a talking head as you can tell, like they get him after like it dismissed or something.
Yeah.
And like, you know, going back to the 50-year mission, which Emmy mentioned, like the other crew members, the other cast members all talk about how they all hated him. Yeah. Like Leonard Nimoy and him only got along, you know, they got along here and there and they became friends like later in life. But no, I mean, like it's interesting to watch in this, especially when in that segment when they ask all the fans, like, who's your favorite captain? And it's like very overwhelmingly like Captain Kirk is a figure in this fandom that just holds that carries such water and carries such weight. And he's not really in this documentary
at all. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting, yes, it's interesting that he's not in this documentary. And it also just feels like there's just an interesting push and pull. It feels like with him and the franchise and with the series, there's no question, obviously, that he, the only other thing I can even associate him with truly is Boston Public or Boston Legal or whatever it is.
TJ Hooker.
Oh, also, of course. How could I forget TJ Hooker? Priceline.
Yeah, Rescue 911.
Okay.
I was such a Star Trek fan as a kid that I did watch TJ Hooker reruns with my mom, really? And I obsessively watched Rescue 911.
That's fantastic.
I love it.
Shatner would love to hear that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Shatner's just an interesting guy. I don't say that. I really don't say that disparagingly. I think it's watching his clips and thinking about him in this just obviously made me think about Galaxy Quest, and it does feel like they are emulating the tensions between the cast and him in that movie.
Well, and Justin Long feels so much like the kid in this documentary.
Yes.
Of just like what it means to be a fandom and it means to be a fan and really look into the blueprints of the ship and questioning like how do you get to 10 Ford if you're at the, you know, captain's yacht? captain's yacht is a real place.
It is.
I know.
And 10 Ford is the bar.
So, what I was the last guy that they kind of focus on is this guy who seems to be sort of building things.
Oh yeah, he's building Captain Pike's chair.
He's building.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Well, like I thought that was like it was interesting too because they talk about like the ways Star Trek has influenced science and engineering, and I was like, oh cool. So they're going to talk about how like you know flip cell phones were clearly based on like old communicators or all the many. The countless ways Star Trek actually impacted science. And they're like, so here's a guy in the middle of nowhere who's an engineer. And he starts talking about what he's doing. And he's like, my friends had, what was it? Like, my friends had pictures of Farrah Fawcett on their walls growing up. I had pictures of Star Trek. And then it cuts to his wall and it's a picture of Captain Pike, who's like scarred and elderly. And like, he just looks kind of horrific. It's a picture from the cage the menagerie. And then it goes into him saying like, this is Captain Pike in the menagerie. He's in a, he's confined to a moving wheelchair and he can't speak. So he communicates through this light and this buzzer, which blinks once for yes and twice for no. And then I was like, okay, so he's making a thing. And then he comes out in it.
Yeah, it's
and
great. It's, like,
it's
amazing.
And then he's really writing functional. It down the street. Yeah, it's great. Like, it was, yeah.
It's the part it's that wild. I loved mm-hmm. was when he went to Radio Shack and yes. he's talking to the guy.
Oh, and
the
that guy is like, clearly
what
did
the
not,
fuck
yeah.
is happening?
That man was
he keeps
not having
looking
it.
At the camera.
Yeah. With his military say, buzz cut. Yeah.
It's fucking amazing.
Yeah.
And he walked, like, the guy's like, so I was thinking, I'm trying to do this, this, and this. And do you think I need this or do you think I need this? It just cuts the guy who, like, does a side eye and then cuts away. It's yeah. fantastic.
Yeah. There
is
so
really good stuff.
Yeah. There's so many great, like, peripheral characters. I almost think of them yeah. like that in this. Like when the Klingon crew goes to the Carl's Jr. and they,
yes, yes,
after
yes.
they meet up for the convention and they all like storm into the Carl's Jr. Well, they don't storm in. They walk in very politely and kindly.
And then they ask, have you ever served anyone?
Yeah, they ask the cashiers. They're like, have you ever served any Klingons? And they're like, yeah. Like, you know?
It's great.
It's just so charming.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, that's what I would say about this whole movie is that it is charming. It does feel like a love letter, despite sometimes mm-hmm. feeling a little bit prickly or a little bit sort of a little mockingly towards mm-hmm. some things. It does feel like a love letter towards their fans. And it is from the fact that Denise is the sort of the face of this mm-hmm. thing helps too, in terms of just getting people to you feel like you're getting the real from these people, that these people are definitely enamored with her and enamored with the series and she's getting them to open up in a way that perhaps other documentarians mm-hmm. might not. And it does feel, it feels again like a Valentine. It doesn't feel like they're trying to be shitty towards anybody.
There's like an earnest quality to yeah, it. Yeah. Just earnest in the fans themselves.
Totally.
Being really open, but also earnest in the way it's filmed.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
So did you guys see this in 99?
No.
No.
Had you seen this before?
No.
Also no.
Really?
I had heard a lot about it. I mean, it's
I'm
to the point
genuinely
that
genuinely surprised.
It's difficult to find. Also, I was in the Middle East in the 90s, so like we didn't see anything. So we certainly didn't see Trekkies.
Yeah. I remember hearing about it and being a little skeptical and thinking like it was going to potentially like look down its nose at Trek fans.
Right.
Just like the calling it Trekkies in 99, mm-hmm. it was a term right. that I was generally like called a Trekkie by people who meant it derisively.
And you beat them up.
Yeah, exactly. Fight. Now, Phil, much like Captain Picard would, I find a rational solution. I pull all my best friends into my ready room and I yeah. say,
what's going right, to do with this?
Yeah, what are we going to do? Yeah. This man made fun of me for liking Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's go around the room. Yeah. Mark, what do you
it's reasonable.
Think?
Yeah. It's reasonable. So neither of you, I'm genuinely surprised that neither of you had seen this up until yeah. this point. So no. you, so fresh eyes on this.
Yeah.
So I did see this in 99. Mm-hmm. I want to say that I rented it from either a video store that I was working at or frequented, whatever the case might be. But mm-hmm. I do remember seeing it and liking it and thinking it was funny. And again, like I keep thinking about like your mockumentaries that were sort of coming out mm-hmm. around the same time. So you had Waiting for Guffman, you had sort of the Chris Guest stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't remember when the British Office started. I think it was in the early 2000s, if I'm not mistaken, but maybe I'm wrong.
Thanks.
But my point is more that I saw it sort of through the lens of I can't believe these people are real sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it nonetheless and didn't feel like it was it was being shitty towards them. But so I did like it back then. But do you guys feel like how do you think you would have felt about it if you had watched it in 99?
I think it would have hurt my feelings, to be honest.
Yeah, I think at the time, like, yeah, it just felt like it was putting Trekkies under a microscope in a way that, like, I don't know, the temperature at the time, like the climate for nerdy fandom was mm-hmm. a lot different than it is now. Like, I still remember as a kid, like in a department store, the first time I ever saw, like, Trekkies in the wild other than like me and my parents mm-hmm. which is to say like they I remember like we were like walking around like a Caldor or something in Connecticut and there was I believe a husband and wife and they were in full TNG uniforms just walking around and like as a kid I was just like what you know I found it sure. so fascinating because I had heard of conventions and I had like you know seen photos in magazines but like I had never seen anybody walking around in like these very accurate uniforms and I remember just kind of like spectating on them from afar like it was a you know a very nerdy anthropological thing
I could see that
yeah but even then I remember like my parents who loved Star Trek mind you they were like oh yeah no you don't need to don't do that like you don't want to, you know that was just the climate it was like oh it's nice that those people are walking around it's nice that they like it but like yeah you shouldn't do that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you think that you had you watched in 99, you would. So how old were you in 99?
14.
13.
Right. So a little bit more sensitive to that.
Yeah, and being insecure about, you know, liking anything that wasn't cool or normal or popular. Certainly, and associating it with, like, family time and, like, I was trying to be a cool kid and not let people know that I was into Lord of the Rings and stuff. I did – in watching this, I did think back. This girl in my high school invited me over to Bilbo Baggins' birthday party right before Lord of the Rings came out. And I remember even that being like, you know, and she dressed up for it and I didn't dress up, but, like, I attended and being like, oh, I can't tell anybody else that I was here because I will be judged. Oh. And I think there was, like, only, like, 10 of us that came to the party. And yeah, you know, you feel sensitive about that stuff. So I think if I had watched this documentary kind of mocking some of the people that, like, I would have associated with, I would have felt bad. But now watching it, I'm like, this is so cool. I love going to Star Trek Vegas. Like, that was awesome.
Yeah, it's a really cool artifact and, like, showing just how things were at that time and, like, how into it some of these people were. Like, it was really fun and kind of heartwarming to watch.
Yeah,
I totally agree. It's a shame that coronavirus is going to ruin conventions forever.
I know.
We're never going to go to them again. But, you know, at least we had them while we had them,
right? We did.
Yeah.
So do you want to rate this movie? Do you remember, you want to sort of pre-podcast, give this a movie a rating? Have we done, you don't know what this is?
No, because I've only done the TV show with
you. So what we do on this podcast is we rate the movies from 0 to 99. 0 being the lowest, 99 being the highest.
Okay.
50% being the threshold with which to recommend this. Generally speaking, we rate it, if you've seen it in 99, which I have, I will give it a rating in 99. Then we do a rating before we recorded this podcast and then a rating after it, as though perhaps the podcast might have changed your rating.
Okay.
Which, more times than not, it doesn't really. But we just put it in there just to, for whatever. So I'll go first. In 99, I think I would have given this a 70. I liked it. It didn't change my world, but I enjoyed it. So I think now or before the podcast, I'd give it a 72. It went up in my esteem, but
two
also felt
points.
Like two whole points, but I also feel like it didn't necessarily, all the things that we were talking about, which is that it felt short. It felt a little cursory. It felt like at times it wasn't really digging into this fandom or into fandom in general. And I'm kind of holding at a 72, quite honestly. Like, it hasn't really changed one way or the other, but that's fair. Please, whoever wants to go first.
I'd give it an 86.
Oh, shit. Okay. Before and after?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Like a solid B.
Yeah, no, that's...
Yeah, I'd say, like, especially the people I know who work in the Trek universe now and people who enjoy Trek, I would recommend. I feel like my parents who love Star Trek too, I feel like I don't think they would enjoy it as much. I mean, I'm trying to think, like, my mom loves Star Trek. It is her, like, comfort food. When we went to our first Comic-Con, we immediately found the Klingons, and I have so many adorable pictures of her standing next to her first Klingon.
That's adorable.
Yeah, so I don't know if, like, some of the attitude that this documentary takes towards people like that, I don't necessarily know if I would recommend it to her.
I hear that.
But, yeah, an 86.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd give it, like, a solid 80. I don't know, it's really charming.
It is.
Even though, like, I kind of left it wishing... Truthfully, like, yeah, the HBO example, like, I wish it was longer. I wish it had been able to go more in depth into some of these things, because I think they there's so much good stuff you can get to. I wanted to see more about Mistress Janeway.
Yeah,
you know, I could have used another 10 minutes of Data and Tasha Yar fan fiction.
I said this off the pod, but Mistress Janeway, available on Amazon.
Do you have any?
I do.
Can you give us a little bit of just a taste?
I'm going to give a taste.
Just a little
taste. Okay. I thought I would have to wait for my first opportunity to approach Mr. Kim, but I was presented with it at the end of the meeting. I was reading over the reports left with me as my staff filed out. Then I noticed Mr. Kim remained nervously shuffling his things, waiting for my attention. I glanced up, and he asked for permission to speak to me for a moment. I always adored that in him, I realized. He was already fairly well-trained. Perhaps the whip wouldn't be necessary on him.
Wow.
So again, we need an episode going deeper into all of this.
Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
No, yeah, it's a...
your face right now.
I just... Yeah, okay. Sure.
I'll do the audiobook for it, too.
That's... I mean, listen, I appreciate fan fiction. Mm-hmm. I really do. I think that it's a tremendous thing. It really is. And you know, that level of engagement, people loving the characters as much as they do. I think that stuff's all great.
Yeah. So like 1 hour about this, you know, that you can end this miniseries with Gabriel's fan fiction movie. I truthfully wanted to see it at the end. I thought it was so charming that he, like, especially in 99, seeing these like computer generated stuff, you know, graphics and ships he designed. All I could think is like in 99 on a home PC, that must have been a hell of a lot of work.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine.
And I just found all that so charming. So, yeah, I wanted to see so much more of that stuff. And but, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a good thing if you leave a movie wishing for more.
Yeah, I guess we should watch the second one.
I mean,
but it didn't come out in 1999.
No, but I just mean, like, we as in humans, the three of us could watch it sometime. Okay, I'd be game for watching it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you. This has been a lot of fun.
I would come back.
We'll both come back. We'll find another movie. We'll find some TV shows.
We still need to talk about 13th Warrior.
We do need to talk about
the best movie of 1999.
Oh my gosh.
Oh boy.
The first movie I saw a fist fight break out in.
What?
First of all, first?
I mean, you know the other one.
Fair enough.
That makes it sound like you and I got in a fist fight. No, Phil and I just witnessed a fist fight in a movie, which oddly near empty theater, which made it all the crazier.
Yeah, but 13th Warrior, you really think it's the best movie of 1999?
Sure, I'll say that.
You haven't seen a lot of movies that came out in 99, though.
That's true.
Yeah, double down. I like just the very quick, like, yes.
All right. Yeah. Well, you still need to come up for Wing Commander. That's still happening.
Obviously, the threat of Wing Commander being unleashed upon your listeners. Happening. Yeah.
Well, thank you both for coming on.
Yeah.
And thank you to our listeners. Please rate, review, subscribe.
And watch Lower Decks when it comes out in fall of 2020 on CBS All Access. It'll probably be available on YouTube as well, because I think we're like premiering the first episode.
Okay.
Available everywhere in case you don't have CBS All Access. And then you'll buy CBS All Access and you'll just have Star Trek for life.
I'm going to go down a limb and say you'll probably be on again before it's on in the fall, since it's...
But we also might be quarantined, so who knows?
Yeah.
This might be the last time I see you.
This is true, too. Please watch Lower Decks when it premieres in the fall in various forms.
Lower Decks.
Yes, thank you so much for listening.
Bye.
Live long and prosper.
Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it. You want a podcast like it.